Как оно управляется?
Вот я тоже пытаюсь разобраться. А, это я микрофон включаю, это не...
Блин, микрофон-то включим.
Да. Русского языка нет.
So good afternoon. Thank you all for being here today discussing a very important topic that is on our hearts in the Council of Europe Parliamentary Assembly. It has been, it's the purpose of this House to defend the human rights, but since the large-scale war and aggression against Ukraine, it has been particularly alarming. Today I'm introducing rather than moderating a discussion. We have some very good speakers. We have the Norwegian Helsinki Committee. They talk about the new initiative. We have Vladimir Karamurza, who all of you know. And we only have 1 hour. So let's begin with this. I give the word to Lisa Selnes. And we go with this order as we sit. Lisa.
Thank you very much. My name is Lise Selnes. I'm the head of delegation for the Norwegian delegation here in PASE. And I'm also a representative in Stortinget for the political party, Labour Party, who is also having the Prime Minister in Norway right now. I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you so much to invite me. Nordic and Baltic countries are strong promoters of international law and a rule-based world order. They have solid traditions of confronting human rights violation and crimes through legal means. This applies to violation in our own countries, but it also how we relate to other countries. We believe that the rule of law requires us to be proactive in addressing human rights violations also committed by Russian authorities. We must continually seek ways to address them, even if Russia is no longer a member of the Council of Europe. That does not mean we should give up on pursuing justice. Those suffering from human rights violations within Russia deserves justice. Human rights violations are not a matter of internal affairs. Unaddressed violations remain a security risk, both internally and externally. Repression at home is exported as aggression abroad. There is really no place for human rights neutrality in today's Europe. We must take a stance and support those working for democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. Often their work is a great personal risk. However, we cannot address human rights violations in Russia without having detailed information about them. The kind of initiative we're going to hear about today. The Accountability Initiative for Russia is of vital importance if we're going to be credible and serious in our references to international law. At the heart of the initiative is a realization that systematic documentation of human rights violations and war crimes is vital to be able to confront this wrongdoing in courts, with sanctions, and by telling the truth. Systematic, in this context, means building robust documentation systems that enable the collection, digitalization, and analysis of a vast volume of documentation. Documentation of violations is the raw material of justice. At this time, we do not know what form of justice will take place. It can take place in Europe courts that try suspects of international crimes, such as crimes against humanity. It can be targeted sanctions which deny visas and freeze the assets of human rights violators. It can be the UN, the International Criminal Court, or other international institutions that hear crimes and abuse. It can be parliamentary hearings and reports, and many other ways of presenting the facts and applying the law as best as we can. To ensure the quality and availability of that raw material, the documentation of injustices, is at the heart of the accountability initiative for Russia. The Council of Europe has recently taken lead when it comes to documentation of crimes committed by Russia in Ukraine. The Claims Commission and Special Tribunal established under the Council of Europe is now in being signed and ratified in member states and beyond. This is an important step for justice for those affected by Russia's war of aggression. The Accountability Initiative for Russia, which we will now learn more about, will hopefully contribute to justice for all Russians suffering from human rights violations within Russia. I commend the initiative and look forward to hear from Mr. Vladimir Karamusha, who is the next speaker. He has first-hand experience with the brutality of the ongoing human rights violation by the Russian regime against its people. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair of the delegation, Mr. Chairman of our hearing. Thank you so much to everybody who's here. And I want to express my deepest gratitude to the organizers of this public event, but first and foremost to the authors of this new accountability initiative for Russia. Just two very short news stories from this week, from our country. On Monday of this week, the authorities in the Siberian city of Tomsk have removed, dismantled a public monument to the victims of Soviet-era political repression. The monument itself, as well as the separate memorial stones dedicated to Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians, Poles, and Kalmyks, who were murdered by the NKVD in that particular Siberian city. This was the first initiative, but I think it is unfortunately pretty safe to say that not the last, because of course the Memorial Society that was originally the initiator of this remembrance back in the 1990s has recently been declared by the Russian government as a so-called extremist organization. And a second news story came just from today, when Vladimir Putin signed a decree renaming the Academy of the FSB, the Federal Security Service of the Russian Federation, with the name of Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Soviet machine of state terror, the Cheka and KVD, later KGB. And you may ask, what does this have to do with the topic of our conversation today? Well, this has everything to do with the topic of this conversation, because this word accountability, that is the center of this event, was something that never happened in Russia after the collapse of the communist regime in 1991. We know from world history that any country that has gone through the trauma of totalitarianism, that has gone through crimes against humanity, that has gone through genocide, has to have accountability and justice as an essential element of any transition to democratic normality. This happened in different ways, in different formats, in different countries of the world. Sometimes the instruments were national, sometimes they were international. We know that, you know, in South Africa after apartheid, they had the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. In Argentina, after the military junta of the 80s, they had judicial tribunals. In many Central and Eastern European countries, they had lustrations procedures introduced, where people who had been complicit in the crimes of the old regimes were blocked from ever again holding positions of power. Sometimes justice has been on the international level, as of course, probably the most prominent two examples are the international tribunals for the genocide in Rwanda and for the former Yugoslavia. But in any case, whatever the format, whatever the specific model, this accountability is an absolutely needed element of any transition to democracy after the trauma of totalitarianism. Back in the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet regime, there were far-sighted, principled people in our country, in Russia, who were arguing for precisely this. Vladimir Bukovsky, the legendary Soviet dissident who spent more than 12 years in the Soviet Gulag, spent all of 1991, 92, 93 going around government offices in Moscow trying to persuade President Yeltsin's administration to open the archives of the former Communist Party Central Committee and the KGB, to introduce lustration measures to make sure the people who were complicit in these crimes could never again come to a position of authority, to hold a judicial tribunal, to hold those criminals to account, and of course, needless to say, to dismantle the repressive apparatus of Soviet state terror that was responsible for the deaths of millions and millions of people in our own country and in other countries. Galina Starovoyteva, a very prominent member of the Russian parliament, one of the leaders of the Democratic Russia movement, on two different occasions introduced into the Russian parliament a draft law on lustrations, modeled on a similar measure already by then enacted in Czechoslovakia, a law that would have barred former senior officials of the Soviet Communist Party and former officers, agents, and informants of the Soviet KGB from holding any position of executive authority. Had that law been passed, Vladimir Putin would never have been able to become deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, let alone prime minister, president of Russia. And then, of course, in November of 1992 came the landmark dissenting opinion by Constitutional Court Judge Anatoly Kononov, who wrote that based on all the evidence and all the witness testimony and all the expert testimony uncovered during the Constitutional Court case regarding the Soviet Communist Party in 1992 that ended with a toothless and inconsequential decision, but in Kononov's view, there was enough evidence uncovered during those hearings that would warrant an actual real criminal tribunal against the former Soviet communist regime on the basis of international statutes of which the Soviet Union was a member, statutes relating to genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Now, unfortunately, as we know, none of this happened. The lustrations law was never even debated. Kononov's opinion was a dissenting opinion. It did not have any legal force. And when Bukovsky was arguing for the opening of the archives and a public trial against the communist system, he was just told, you know, these government officials would shrug on him and they would say, what you are proposing is going to be a witch hunt, they said. And then he turned back to them and said, well, in that case, the witches will return and start hunting us. And this was exactly what happened when just a few years later, a Soviet KGB officer came to power in Russia, which he has held now for the past 26 years. We do not have the right to repeat that mistake. And to me, an essential element of any post-Putin democratic transition in Russia has to be that accountability, which we are here to talk about, and that transitional justice that never happened back in the 1990s. And of course, I'm talking about this justice and accountability, both for the crimes committed by the Putin regime against our own people in Russia, the assassination of Boris Nemtsov, the assassination of Alexei Navalny, the persecution of thousands and thousands of political prisoners over the years. And of course, I'm talking about accountability for crimes committed by Putin's regime outside of our borders, in Georgia, in Syria, in Ukraine, the first time after 2014, and the second time with a full-scale invasion that's been going on since 2022. And it is really important to prepare the groundwork for that future accountability and justice today. There are many important bodies and organizations that are already engaged in this work. We know that the International Criminal Court is already detailing and investigating crimes committed by the Russian army in Ukraine. We know that this organization, the Council of Europe, has been the initiator of the Special International Tribunal for the Crime of Aggression against Ukraine that hopefully we will see start practical work very soon. Organizations like the Council of Europe, like the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, are doing very important oversight work that is also laying the ground for this future process of transitional justice. I would name out of many just two particular documents. One was the resolution and report on Russian political prisoners that was adopted by this assembly back in 2022. And it was actually Eric Nilis Cross's signature that was the first one initiating that process. And this is a very powerful international document relating to political persecution in Russia. It's resolution 2446 of 2022. And another document I would name is the OSCE report on the investigation into the assassination of Boris Nemtsov that was published in February of 2020 by Special Rapporteur Margareta Cederfeld of Sweden, who later became the president of the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly. And this is the most comprehensive and detailed international legal document on the Nemtsov murder case that includes witness testimony pointing to where, when, and how Vladimir Putin gave the order for that assassination. All this information, all these details, all this evidence is crucial. And the initiative that is being announced here today, the Accountability Initiative for Russia, will be a very important part of this work. And I want to take this opportunity to thank the Norwegian Helsinki Committee that is going to take the burden of this work, of this chronicling, of this documentation. And the last thing I would say is, speaking more as a historian than as a politician or a former political prisoner, the one thing we definitely know from the modern history of Russia is that major political change in our country usually happens like this, swiftly, suddenly, and completely unexpectedly. Both the Tsarist regime in 1917 and the communist regime in 1991 collapsed in 3 days, literally speaking, and nobody saw it coming. There's a really good book by a prominent Russian-American anthropologist, Alexei Yurchak, published a couple of years ago in Berkeley, California, on the later years of the Soviet regime. And the title of the book is, It Was Forever Until It Was No More. And that's exactly how the Soviet regime ended. This is exactly how the Putin regime will end as well. None of us knows when this is going to happen. This could be in 3 years, this could be in 2 weeks. But we need to be ready for that moment. And the essential element of any post-Putin transition in Russia has to be that justice and accountability, because we owe it to our children and grandchildren, we owe it to the rest of Europe, we owe it to the whole civilized world to ensure that those witches never, ever return again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vladimir. And now Günther Schirmer. Günther, by the way, is the secret force behind most of those documents that Vladimir talked about. He's a former head of legal secretariat here, and now I'm very pleased that he can speak openly.
It feels funny to be back next in the same meeting room that our committee met at, next to the chairman. So, I was asked to make a brief presentation on the position of Parliamentary Assembly in the, on impunity, fighting impunity. And I am proud to say that as of 2009, even, we had two former German ministers of justice as committee members and chairpersons. Mrs. Döbler-Gmelin summed up the Assembly's position as follows. The Assembly considers the fight against the impunity of perpetrators of serious human rights violations as a priority for the Council of Europe and all national and international law enforcement bodies. Impunity must be eradicated both as a matter of individual justice and as a deterrent for future human rights violations. The Assembly also commends the European Court of Human Rights for the extensive case law it has developed on impunity, in particular by imposing on member states the positive obligation to investigate serious human rights violations and to hold their perpetrators to account. Sabine Leutheusser-Schnarrenberger, another former German justice minister, and Christos Pouguridis, also a wonderful chairman of our committee at the time, applied these principles in their reports respectively on the murder of Ukrainian journalist Gongadze and on the high-profile disappearances in Belarus, and they stressed the need to investigate the entire chain of command. The authorities must not only identify the actual perpetrators, but also the instigators and organizers without regard to the rank and position of the suspects. Dick Marty, another former chairman and a career prosecutor, was probably the most influential fighter against impunity in the Assembly. In 2006 and 2007, he prepared two sensational reports documenting human rights violations by the CIA committed in Europe in the so-called War on Terror. And these CIA reports were much applauded by the Russian delegation, and Dick Marty was accused of being anti-American. And to demonstrate that he was not anti any country, but anti-impunity, he took on a rapporteur mandate on the human rights situation in the North Caucasus region. And I must say the fact-finding visit to the region, which I had the honor of accompanying, was probably the most bizarre and frightening mission in my entire career. And interestingly, one of Ramzan Kadyrov's henchmen, who was well known to us from the files, between two meetings tapped me on my shoulder and said, Mr. Schirmer, am I on the Council of Europe's list of war criminals? There was and still is no such list, but I told him that I would check this long list once back in Strasbourg and I would send him an email. I told Dick Marty about this incident and he instructed me to add the creation of such a list in the future draft recommendation. But the Committee of Ministers, despite the unanimously adopted recommendation with Russia around the table, could not find consensus to accept our recommendation. The recommendation was literally within the Council of Europe and with the collaboration of non-governmental organizations working in this field, a record-keeping system for the witness statements, documents, and evidence substantiating human rights violations committed in the region. And, well, the Committee of Ministers did not find consensus to accept our recommendation, but as many of you may know, some good people in Norway, and some of them are here, took up the proposal and set up what is now the Natalia Estemirova Documentation Center in Oslo. I trust this excellent initiative by the Norwegian Helsinki Committee and its Russian partners will play an even more important role in future, far beyond the boundaries of the North Caucasus region. This is what we are talking about today, after all. Finally, Digmati struck out against impunity in the 2011 report on serious abuses committed by some members of the Kosovo Liberation Army. And the Prime Minister and former KLA leader, Hashim Thaçi, and some other senior KLA officials are still being tried. And a judgment is what we hear expected shortly. I mention this case because it's one of the rare cases where the perceived victors and not only the losers of a conflict have been brought to trial for alleged war crimes, up to and including the highest level of command. It's a good precedent. Another approach to fight impunity is the Assembly's work on the case of Sergei Magnitsky. This helped Bill Browder's campaign in favor of Magnitsky laws the world over, which Vladimir Karamoza has helped a lot with. These global Magnitsky laws target perpetrators of human rights violations from the world over. And last year, this Assembly called for Magnitsky sanctions against the Turkish judges and prosecutors who keep Osman Kavala imprisoned, despite two powerful judgments of the European Court of Human Rights demanding his release. And of course, very strong admonitions by the Committee of Ministers. Targeted sanctions as such as account freezes and visa bans, are only needle pricks, but they can hurt especially those who, through their crimes, have accumulated huge wealth that they would rather spend in pleasanter places than today's Russia. And since the start of Russia's full-scale war of aggression against Ukraine, the Assembly has focused in particular on criminal responsibility at international level for war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and the crime of aggression. Tomorrow will be the debate on the special tribunal that this Assembly has initiated already in April 2022. We were then considered naive, crazy. You were there. And the idea has run its course. We had the report by Mr. Pocci, who is now the Polish ambassador here, was then the EPP chair, and followed up by more reports of this committee, of the Assembly, by Damien Cottier and Davos Stier. And now it's getting somewhere. We have a basic agreement. The only point that is still under discussion, it's an impunity issue as well, should or should not the Troika, the President, Prime Minister, and Foreign Minister, enjoy the traditional immunity from prosecution. There are actually precedents for international tribunals that did not hold the Troika members immune. The ICTY prosecuted Slobodan Milosevic, and the International Tribunal for Sierra Leone prosecuted and convicted Sierra Leone President Charles Taylor. And the latter tribunal was also set up without UN Security Council approval, and the International Court of Justice, when it was challenged, accepted this as being in conformity with international law. Sadly, since Donald Trump became president of the USA, the US delegation with the core group of 40 plus countries that are participating in this initiative, in the creation of this tribunal, have withdrawn. But this need not prevent the other core group participants from setting up the tribunal. The US will be free to rejoin the group under a future president who will hopefully support a rules-based international order and the fight against impunity. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Gunnar.
Yes, thank you. I'm very honored to be here in the framework of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, which has initiated so many important initiatives against impunity. I will start with one observation and one fact. The fact is that the Norwegian Helsinki Committee, in cooperation with Russian and international human rights defenders and lawyers, has developed a new platform for human rights fact work on Russia. And we call it the Accountability Initiative for Russia, AIR. And the observation is that it's very important to note that we use the small word for Russia. So it's not an initiative against Russia. And for us, as a human rights people, it's very important to underline that what we do is actually to the benefit of the Russian people. So I'll tell you in short ways what the initiative is about. First, what will AIR do that is not already being done by others? AIR intends to collect in a tailor-made database relevant documents, audio, video, still photos, satellite images, and so on, other forms of documentation, detailing human rights violations committed by the Russian state or its proxies on Russian territory or on territory it controls. So the focus is the crimes against people inside Russia, not on Russia's war crimes being committed in Ukraine. We are part of efforts to document those crimes as well, including Ukrainian police, prosecutorial services, the ICC, the UN, the OSCE, and the Council of Europe, and several states. AIR is different. It aims to establish a digital repository of information to enable accountability for violations within Russia and the territory it controls. And there is another important distinction. The novelty of AIR is not that it will produce documentation. Many actors do that very efficiently. And I'm very honored to see Ole Orlov here, heading one of the most important human rights organizations, together with Karina Moskalenko and other human rights defenders from Russia. We are not taking over their job. We cannot. It's impossible for our Norwegian organizations to do that. But what we think we can add is a systematic approach to developing a documentation system which collects all the high-quality documentation which already exists and which is being produced as we are here today. AIR will not compete with Russian organizations or international organizations. It will supplement their work. It will add another layer of safeguarding the material they all produce and put it into an effective and well-tested digital system, a database application called the Investigation Documentation System, or IDOC. And it's produced by a think tank and has been tested during the last 15 years in different conflict situations. We use it in North Caucasus, in the Natalia Stemirova Documentation Center. We use it in Ukraine and in a few other conflict situations. In this way, AIR will support victims in their pursuit of justice and truth and advance the broader struggle for democracy, the rule of law, and respect for human rights in the Russian Federation. In short, AIR will gather, manage, and prepare the vast raw material for accountability measures that already exist or are continually produced. And we use the word accountability because it's wide. It's not only about criminal justice, which is an important part of it, but there are other forms and other important forms of accountability which we also have in mind. Of course, Magnitsky sanctions, but also truth-telling and recognizing the crimes against civilian people. So my second question is, why is a Norwegian human rights organization spearheading the initiative rather than Russian organizations? I have, of course, been asked about that. And this is because I think we can do it. Russian organizations have asked us to do it. We have experience and a proven record of working with both Russian and international organizations on large documentation projects. An important part of AIR will also be to strengthen civil society actors. We will cooperate with and assist them in documenting and protecting victims. And I think it's very important to have in mind that there is a kind of crisis in human rights work in Europe and globally because of the substantially reduced funding for human rights work. At the same time as human rights organizations become much more efficient, coordinated, funding is not there. So that is also a part of our motives. We will try to not steal money from any open calls. We will try to persuade governments who think like us that accountability is part of the solution to come up with additional funding. Maybe it's also a symbolic strength that we're based in Oslo, which has a reputation for spreading more or less successfully human rights, peace, and democracy. That's what we want to think. We can play a role, but we can only succeed if we manage to cooperate well with other actors. My last question. Do we really have the resources and the money to realize the initiative? The short answer is no. At the present moment, we don't have the necessary resources. We don't start from scratch, but we need more resources. We have registered AIR under Norwegian law. It has a legal existence, but it still lacks sufficient funding. So I'm here also to ask for your moral and political support. Ultimately, we need your support in telling governments and other potential donors that AIR makes sense and should be financially supported. I cannot give you a complete budget at this time. How much will AIR cost over the years? It's a long-term, large-scale project. We aim to build a solid resource base as soon as possible, making us able to work fast. However, AIR is a civil society project, much less costly than intergovernmental inquiry commissions with similar aims. One thing is important for us. AIR shall not compete with already money-strapped Russian and international human rights organizations. Instead, we will seek special funding arrangements with governments and other donors who recognize its importance. Any assistance you can provide will be very welcome. So I hope you agree that in this way, AIR will support also an important campaign I hope you heard about. It's the People's First campaign, which aims to shed light on and prioritize support for Ukrainians in Russian captivity during peace negotiations. They should be released now. If you like, I can give you an elevator pitch for what AIR is about. Gathering and analyzing facts about human rights violations in Russia to make justice and accountability possible on the largest possible scale. It will document past abuses to provide justice today and tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Vadim Prokhorov, please.
Me.
Most of us also know you.
Good afternoon. So as a Russian lawyer, I would like to tell about those people on which help we hope in this project. Just for remind, there are about 85,000 lawyers in Russia, but in fact, only a small part of them is actually is the last part of the civil society in Russia. Russian human rights lawyers, very few of them, but they play a significant role in protecting Russian political prisoners and also Ukrainian hostages. And at the same time, it should be noted that in recent years, the situation has damaged dramatically and has become much more dangerous for them. For me, it's clear that we hope on support of our Russian human rights lawyers, of our colleagues in this project. and that we rely when working on this project in the stage of collecting, preserving, and analyzing the necessary documentation. But it's important at the same time to remember that along the increased role of the human rights lawyers in Russia, the risks for them in Russia also have increased significantly, many, many times over, especially recent years. Now, working as a human rights lawyer in Russia actually requires heroism, in fact. And you must not be just only a lawyer, but you must be really to risk your life and freedom, unfortunately, because the Putin's regime has become an active attack on human rights lawyers who effectively do their job. However, human rights lawyers in Russia themselves have come under threat of becoming victims of the crimes committed by the Putin regime. And this way, they risk being included in our own database as the victims of these cases. Let me give you one very, very particularly urgent example. We have a very highly professional, a very prominent lawyer. She is our brave colleague. Her name is Maria Bonsler, and just now she's detained in Kaliningrad. Kaliningrad, you know, it's the region in the west part of Russian Federation. Previously, it has been East Prussia, and it has been included as a part of the Soviet Union as a result of the Second World War. Her grandfather was born in Königsberg before the World War II. She has German origin, and she's a very, very prominent lawyer in the field of human rights protection, defending political prisoners, defending Ukrainian hostages. And just now, Maria Bonsler is being held in detention in Kaliningrad. Now she's behind the bars. The Russian authorities have charged her under Article 275 of the Criminal Code of Russian Federation, high treason. By the way, Vladimir Karamurza has been charged to the accusation on this article himself. And the only ground for this accusation is that she provided professional legal defense to a Ukrainian detainee during this legal help, where is this provided, she communicated with his relatives living in Ukraine. It's just only the ground for her detention. And just now, as a result, she faces a sentence from 12 years of imprisonment till life sentence. She's 66 this year. Her health is quite poor just now, and in fact, for her, it's death penalty. This is a striking example of how Russian human rights lawyers, our colleagues themselves, can become victims of crimes of the Putin regime, and how their cases may ultimately be included in our AIR database. And I'm absolutely sure that cases of Boris Nemtsov, assassination of Boris Nemtsov, assassination of Alexei Navalny shall be also included into these databases as very, very important cases. And however, even in these conditions, our heroic colleagues continue to fight for freedom in Russia and for the rights of their clients. And accountability depends on the work of Russian lawyers and human rights defenders. And when they are unlawfully imprisoned and subjected to a torture, they can become victims of their injustice they fired themselves. So I think that we cannot leave them without our international protection. It would be very unfair.
Thanks. Thank you very much. This is amazing because we actually have 20 minutes for a debate, for a discussion. It happens seldom. You were all very disciplined.
Instructions. Yes, exactly.
So, who wants to ask questions? And if you ask a question, then also maybe you can tell to whom the question is. Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. You can hear me? I'm sorry. Before my question, I would like to note that yesterday, unfortunately, marked the 30th anniversary of the assassination by Russia of the first president of the Chechen Republic of Ichkeria, Dzhokhar Dudayev. Within a decade, Russia assassinated four Chechen presidents elected by universal suffrage. And installed Ramzan Kadyrov as the head of its occupation regime in Chechnya. And today, some Russians blame Chechens for Kadyrov, unfortunately. During the Fourth Chechen War, Russia-Chechen War, under the pretext of restoring the constitutional order, Russia tortured and killed civilians. And during the Second Russian-Chechen War, Putin turned Grozny into the most destroyed city in the whole world under the guise of anti-terrorist operations. Yet it has never been held accountable for all these crimes. And my question will be, do you think that Europe soon will be ready to recognize and condemn the first crime of Putin's regime, the occupation of Chechnya, which was recognized by the Verkhovna Rada of Ukraine in 2022, and understand the necessity of the decolonization of Russia? Because without this decolonization, Russia's threat will not disappear even after Putin and even after the victory of Ukraine. Thank you.
Who should answer this? I mean, I wish someone had an answer to this, of course.
Absurd.
The only thing I can say is that the Parliamentary Assembly has remained neutral as regards the political outcome of the attempts of the Chechen people to become independent, but the Assembly has very strongly condemned and called for the prosecution of all the war crimes and crimes against humanity committed during the two invasions of Chechnya. There's ample case law of the court also, as you know. But the question of the international law that you raise is not the competence of the Council of Europe. At least that is what the Council of Europe considered the limit of its competences. So that is something for the UN or for other bodies. The Council of Europe has had a neutral position on that. But the Kadyrov, I mean, I had the doubtful pleasure of meeting with Ramzan Kadyrov when we went to see on the last fact-finding mission that Kadyrov allowed. He acted very strangely, and it was really Mr. Marty later was invited by the Schwurgericht in Vienna as an expert witness on the case of the two Chechen murderers who killed Uma Izrailov in the street in Vienna and who were caught. And Dick Marty courageously publicly stated that he found that Ramzan Kadyrov was a psychopath, a dangerous psychopath. What we had seen from him during our visit was, as I said, rather bizarre. And it is a scandal that such a person was in charge of a million people over there with the right of death and life over your whole Chechen people. But that is the human rights situation, which was horrific, probably the worst in Europe at any time, maybe with the exception of some parts of Ukraine occupied by Russia at the moment. But the political question is not for us, I'm afraid.
And just very quickly, as a general point, I would say that, of course, absolutely, accountability for the horrendous war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by the Putin regime in Chechnya has to be a very important part of any accountability in post-Putin Russia. And just very small factual correction. You called the Chechen war the first crime of the Putin regime. The first crime of the Putin regime were the apartment bombings in September of 1999, when peaceful Russian citizens sleeping at night in their homes were blown and murdered by the FSB, the Federal Security Service, in Moscow, in Buynaksk, in Volgodonsk, which was that then blamed on quote-unquote Chechen terrorists, and that served as a pretext for the invasion. And there has to be justice and accountability for every single crime committed by this regime against anyone both inside and outside our territory.
Just a small remark. What we are doing is exactly what Vladimir is referring to. In the Natalia Estemirova Documentation Center, we have gathered more than a million files and audio and videos to document what happened during the wars. And we cannot speak openly about everything we do to try to use that documentation to provide some justice. But there are processes that can lead at least in the direction of justice for some of the victims.
Yeah, I would like to say that from my experience like a rapporteur on the assassination of Nemtsov and Navalny, especially in Nemtsov case, we were created special observation of government behavior of Russia Federation during the assassination, and the masterminders, the killers were Chechens. But we understand with here the former head of the Human Rights Committee staff, Mr. Schirmer, creating the report that it's staged by the government, by Mr. Putin regime, staged. So we came to conclusion that Putin and not staged Chechens, who are, of course, they are terrorists, but were masterminders. So we never give the chance for our Council of Europe Parliamentary Assembly have the stand that Chechen people are involved in the terror. And this idea was staged starting, just Vladimir stated, started from the bombings in Moscow by Putin regime about you, about free Chechen people. And we all remember the peaceful politics of Mr. Dudayev before all this happened. So that will be my answer to you in my capacity of General Rapporteur of Human Rights Defenders here in the Committee on Human Rights. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I don't know your name.
My name is Zarema Gasanova, and my question is to Vladimir Karamurza. Within your speech, you mentioned political prisoners and the Putin regime. And my question is, do you consider it's important to address Russians' internal colonial policies within this initiative? And are there plans to establish direct dialogue within the independent indigenous movements? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. So, as you know, from January of this year, there is a platform for dialogue with Russian Democratic Forces here at the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. And by the Assembly's decision, one-third of the seats in the Russian part of the platform is reserved for representatives of indigenous peoples, and one of them is actually sitting right in front of you, Mr. Ruslan Kutayev, former Deputy Prime Minister of Chechnya and National Security Advisor to the President of Chechnya, and we have many other nations represented, and I believe this is exactly how it should be. I think the diversity of our country is richness. It's not a problem. It's amazing that we have 190-plus different national and ethnic groups. It is amazing that there are so many languages, so many cultures, so many religions, and I think, and this is not just I think, this is a point of consensus for most of the Russian opposition, that a post-Putin Russia has to be, well, obviously a democracy, but also it has to be a parliamentary system rather than presidential, with one person holding all the power. And of course it has to be a true federation, or perhaps even a confederation, where you have the maximum amount of authority, not just in things like culture and language, that goes without saying, but also in finance and taxes and education and so on, devolved to the lowest level possible, because it's crazy to try to rule the largest country in the world with 11 time zones that stretches from the Baltic to the Pacific from one office in Moscow. This is unacceptable. And so absolutely we believe in dialogue, and we're actually conducting this dialogue right now.
Yeah, but question was the dialogue with the independent indigenous movements, which is, for example, wants to self-determination for their own republics.
This includes some of the members of the platform. I think if you speak to Mr. Kutaev, he has his very strong ideas and beliefs about the future of the North Caucasus. We may disagree with him and others, but we always sit and we always speak, and we're always frank and respectful to each other. So this dialogue already happens.
Yes, hi, my name is Vilya Chainova, I'm from Sakha Republic. And currently we're having this forced mobilization of our conscript. So most recently, 8 conscripts, they're being held in Khabarovsky Krai, and they've been tortured and beaten, and they were forced to sign a contract to go to war, unfortunately. They're only 18 and 19 years old. They didn't want to sign the contract, they didn't want to go to war. And so therefore, my question is to Vladimir Kara-Murza, as one of the prominent Russian political figures. And I would like to ask you to elaborate your comment, I think, from last year at the French Senate, where it was mentioned that non-Slavs are more willingly killing the Ukrainians. Do you still consider that, or have your views changed?
Thank you for this classic Kremlin propaganda manipulation. I said nothing of the sort, and you're only helping Putin and the FSB by spreading these fake narratives. What I said was that one of the reasons the Russian Defense Ministry is trying to over-conscript and over-mobilize people in the national regions is because this is what the Russian Defense Ministry thinks. This is their thinking. And then a very talented manipulator just took out the words where I quoted the Russian Defense Ministry and pretended that this is actually my opinion. You know better than that, and please stop spending Kremlin disinformation.
Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Gennady Gudkov. I am former vice chairman of the Committee for Security of Russian State Duma for several times. I have a very simple question. You know, impunity, of course, breeds arbitrariness. We understand this. And the Putin regime commits atrocities against both its own citizens and, of course, against those of other countries, and still without any punishment. I have a question. We know all that Putin regime sponsors both domestic and international terrorism and war crimes, yes? International recognition, nevertheless, of these facts is a very important tool for containing of the Putin's regime criminal actions, as well as significant factor of the division of the elites around Putin, which could lead to the further collapse of the regime. I have a very simple question. Why do we stop this work of recognizing Putin's regime as a terroristic one? And why, this is the question to our colleagues from PACE, why we do not still have a list of war criminals? Because it's very essential, it's very important to split, to divide officials, even from the closest circle to Putin. It's very important to weaken this regime inside. If you can answer me this question, I will be very thankful. Thank you.
I do not think that it has stopped, really, recognizing Russia as a terrorist regime. I'm not entirely sure what the PACE resolution wording is, but I think we recognize it as a fascist regime supporting terrorism, something like that. But, of course, recognition as such, it goes country by country. The PACE recognition is more a political statement than legally binding. It's a process. It's a process. And I think you are right, it has slowed since the so-called peace talks, which is shameful that those are called like that. But
And the list of war crimes? Criminals?
The list of war crimes for us, I think the problem would be that if you... War crimes, yes, we could do that. Criminals, you really... I mean, that's upon a court to decide. I think the best we are doing right now is the special tribunal, which that's the work of PACE. And the ICC is doing its part with deported children. So it's a long way. But I remind you that 4 years ago, before February 22, when the big war started, it was the first big debate was that, does Europe even dare to sanction Putin? It was still that maybe we shouldn't do it because it might, you know, provoke them. That was the first psychological threshold that need to be overcome. So we have come a very long way since then. I just hope that we keep going.
Make a very quick point related to this, addressing something Gunnar has said, to this question of whether the so-called Troika should be immune. I think when it comes to Russia, that question is irrelevant. We can spend, you know, a long time debating it academically. But as you know, both the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, and I believe this was actually probably Günther's last report with Peter Omtzigt from the Netherlands as a rapporteur, and followed later by the European Parliament, stated very clearly and publicly that after May of 2024, Vladimir Putin is a usurper because he has stayed in power in direct violation of constitutional term limits. He's not president, he is a usurper. So we can debate academically whether the Troika should be excluded, but he's not in a Troika, not legally speaking. And so I think that's just an important point to make. So there can be these procedures against him already now. And another related but very important point. So since April 2023, or since March 2023, when the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin as an alleged war criminal for the forceful deportation of Ukrainian children, Vladimir Putin has been to two countries that are state parties to the Rome Statute, Mongolia and Tajikistan. Both of them had a legal obligation to arrest him, and they did not. And I think there should be consequences also for these countries that have signed up to and ratified their own statutes and are in clear and flagrant violation of the obligations under that. Because for now, nothing has happened to either of them.
Last remark, if possible, okay, John. Yeah.
So I think it was Günther who made the point that Troika, according to some legal doctrines, can be immune. But I think the point he made was that there are no precedents from international tribunals, which in a way make them less immune.
Yeah. Well, there are actually precedents which allow the prosecution of members of the Troika. And as Vladimir has rightly said, this is academic because Putin is no longer the legitimate president. Mm. And that was also not only put on the table by the Parliamentary Assembly, but also by the European Parliament. They adopted the same view. And so we can be cool about that. The Assembly's last resolution on the special tribunal was there's another one tomorrow, but the last one adopted was that to leave this issue up to the future judges, not to prejudice one way or the other, in order to clear the way to have the tribunal actually set up as soon mm-hmm. as possible. Mm-hmm. And the future judges will know. They will have all the documentation on the table, all the precedents on the table, and they can be trusted to take the right decision. We don't need this to block the creation of the tribunal. Also, one of the main the countries who had the most reluctance against allowing prosecution of Putin and his inner circle were the U.S. And the U.S. are no longer at the table because Mr. Trump doesn't want any of this international law stuff anymore.
And even if we accept the immunity, which is nonsense because it's against the Rome Statute, etc., but even if we accept it, it only goes about the arrest. So the tribunal can still investigate, write the indictments, and be ready with the case. So this is not covered. So, yeah. But unfortunately now, as much as I like talking about that...
One sentence, not more. Thank you, Eric. Thank you for this very important meeting today. Thank you for you all. All your guard are survive. Incredible, risky life, risking your lives for freedom. So
Okay, like a signatory of Act of Independence of my small country, Lithuania, I would like to say thank you for all your incredible biographies. But on the end, probably we should remember here that a few weeks ago, five countries, founders of this Council of Europe, declared, Germany, France, United Kingdom, and others declared that Alexei Navalny was killed intentionally by poisons, and it was countries who found this Council of Europe. Means the government of Russia is using poisons, killing schemes against Russian Democrats on every corner, and next topic for us will be to investigate Russian FSB and SVR activities outside of Russia, giving for them and thinking how to give for them international terrorist status. Thank you.
With this sympathetic note, thank you very much. Thank you for coming, and we'll keep going.
Thank you so much. That was a good conversation.